Oh, well, I was wondering last night, it seemed like a somber, an anxious crowd last night that was really worried and concerned about the direction of things.
Thank you.
In the federal government, and almost a fear that the federal government was changing to something they needed to be afraid of. And I was wondering, as you traveled around and you talked to people in Alaska and elsewhere, are you hearing something similar? Or?
It's pretty similar all around the state. Very concerned. And especially the age group between 45 and 85. The younger ones have been born into the regulatory law, as I mentioned. It's sort of, they don't know any difference. But see, this has been so accelerated over the last 10 years that people between, I say, 45 and 85, they see that change. Okay? They don't feel as if their government's listening to them anymore. And it doesn't help when you have agencies that are so superior to the people of Alaska that have that attitude. The last time that I have seen where agencies considered the wishes of local people was 10 years ago. Park Service is totally arrogant. Fish and Wildlife isn't much better now. And, of course, Forest Service down here has got the attitude that we can arbitrarily do something because it's our forest. Like the Misty Fjords, the decline in flights, no reason, no rhyme, no nothing. But someone made a decision without any input, any decision of any effect upon the economy. The same agency that promoted tourism and it was going to be the solution over timber. And what are we doing? We're not cutting any trees. We're doing nothing of positive. They'll say, we have a restoration project. The restoration was the one problem they had. They're not restoring anything. They talk about it, but they're really not restoring anything. So that's the hostility that the people that are concerned about losing their democracy for their freedom. And they're very, it's very evident. You know, if you think I'm kidding, you just go to a sporting goods store and see how much ammunition is on the shelf. You can't buy it. As soon as it comes in, it's gone. They limit the amount you can buy as one person. That is a fear factor. Now, is it being promoted? Yeah, it probably is in a degree, in the sense that Fox News and some of these news stations, you heard that question yesterday about why is the Homeland Security buying 1.5 billion rounds of ammunition. I cannot identify where that's coming from, but that scares people.
Definite sense that the government is going to be outgunning the, or at least outarmed the citizenry.
Well, this is really, I think, the Obama agenda. Like they say, they'll protect the seven. You heard me last night. They will protect the Second Amendment, but you're only allowed to buy a .22 short rifle, and they got a 308 or 223 30 round clip magazine. Well, you're protecting your Second Amendment, but in reality, they've taken it away from you, and that's very frankly the fear of people. I was pleased with the kids being there. Of course, that was set up by Mrs. Stone, and that was good. I think that I have to get more people to hear. I spent a lot of time in high schools. You'd be surprised that they are concerned. And as youth, most of the time, they do have and thank God for that, a more optimistic outlook on things, because they haven't seen the change. You know? So that was good. I was glad they were there last night.
Do you find that, you mentioned earlier there's a generational difference between the 45s on ups and the younger crowd that has grown up in this situation. And you also spoke of kind of not a dissatisfaction with politics, but kind of a hands-off or...
Well, they don't understand it and the importance of being involved. And unfortunately, other than a few teachers, they don't teach government or history, the foundation of our country, the generation of our states. I'll guarantee you, if we could go back right now under this present situation, no state would vote to be a state of the United States. They'd vote to be a state of the state. You follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They were eager to get into the federal government and be part of, because they were always considered, we had a state's rights. And that's basically been taken away from them. And the states no longer have the role that they should play. And so I think most leaders of the states would say, heck, we're not going to get into the United States.
Well, I was hoping, you touched on this a little bit last night, I was kind of hoping you would expand on the whole budget process and the prospect of, first of all, House and Senate agreeing, and then House and Senate and President agreeing.
Well, if the House and Senate will agree, the President just about has to agree. I mean, there's... But with Harry Reid and Schumer, Durbin, Boxer and Feinstein, and Boehner and Cantor, and Ryan and Kine, it's going to be very hard, because they believe on the House side that they reached an agreement in the waning hours of December 25th. Or 24th, that they reached an agreement that they would raise taxes and there would be no more in this so-called budget thing. Well, if you look at the Senate budget, the first one in 4 years, they raised taxes dramatically and they don't curb spending. And that's just, I think, a terrible non-starter with the House. A lot of this is going to be up to the public, because the public demands a balanced budget, or a budget will be balanced in 10 years, and this is going to, everybody, you heard me last night, everybody has to be part of it. The school teacher there said that, how do we solve this? Everybody says that 85% want a balanced budget. Nobody wants to balance it on their back. And I really think that everybody should consider my 10% solution. It's just everybody put 10% of their salaries, 10% of it, including those on government welfare. So everybody has something in the game, a little skin in the game, including all the agencies and the whole bit. You'd balance the budget. Because it can't be done here, do it there, and don't do it me, it can't be done. It's just, to me, something American people have. Now, if they want to go the route of Greece, they want to go the route of Portugal, then that's what will happen in time. It won't happen overnight. It can happen much quicker than you realize. And I think, again, no one's looking at why we got where we were other than spending. It's because we weren't making anything, as I said yesterday and last night. We are not a country of producing anymore, so we don't have a tax base. There was a time when the middle class was the major tax, and still is, but our middle class has shrunk dramatically. We have a large class of those that do not contribute anything. Again, like Romney is absolutely correct. 47% of the people aren't involved in our government. Then we have the I call it the instant millionaires, billionaires, that made their money through trading of stocks and commodities, and you saw a 17-year-old today just sold his thing to Google. And does it produce anything? Nothing. You're not going to solve it by, you take, like you say, take all that money from the 2%, the billionaires, it runs the country for 30 days. So that's not going to solve the problem. You've got to make business be attracted to the United States again. You have to make sure that the people can get jobs that are trained. Now, will we ever go back to the heydays after the 46 up to about 65, 70? No, because as time went by, the remaining businesses in this country actually have developed methods to bake something. I remember I went to a Ford automobile factory in 1947. I was in high school. They had 20 people building one car. They've got maybe one or two building it now. It's all done by robots. I used to, my father had a ranch. We used to hire 50 to 60 wetbacks and to pick tomatoes. It takes two people to pick the same tomatoes now. It's all done by machine. They don't reach down and pick them. They plant them. They plant them so that and we call lots. And stagger the days, and when the 90% of the tomatoes are ripe. They'll go in a machine and pick it up and shake it, and the ripe tomatoes fall down. They throw the rest away, and they run them into a machine, into a truck. That's how they pick them. Same thing with the beets. We used to raise sugar beets. It was done by hand. We'd chop them with the... we'd take a plow, turn them over, and they'd come in and hit them with a machete with a hook on it, pull them out, chop the deal off, and then they'd throw them into a truck. Now they got a thing that goes through right there and picks them right out of the ground and shakes them, cuts the thing off, throws them in the truck. Two people do the work of 100. And that's all the way through our manufacturing base. But now it takes people to be trained to run those computers. It takes people to build the computers. So that's they'd be making something in that arena. There's no reason that's done overseas. I mean, I have this idea of cheap labor has caused this. It's not that's not the issue. Overseas now, labor is quite high. It's the fact that they can invest and get their money back so much quicker overseas as an investor developing a product for consumption in the United States than can in the United States. Make it more attractive to have it in the United States. And that's where people would reinvest in the United States. You're seeing a little bit of it now, but not as nearly as much as you can. And you have to use your resources. I mean, that's what... there's nothing in this room that didn't come from the ground. But was money of any of it made here? I doubt it. You know? So, it's not good.
So they throw away all the green tomatoes that aren't ripe?
They're not ripe, they throw them away.
And they throw them away?
Yeah. But you get 90% of a crop is probably as good as hand picking. Because, see, none of the tomatoes all get ripe at the same time. Yeah. Even when you're hand picking.
I thought they went back and they got ripe.
No, they don't anymore.
Not anymore, no.
No. That's the way to do it.
Quick clarification on the 10%. You mentioned agencies with that. Is that the agencies would go for a 10% reduction across the board?
Yeah, across the board.
Across the board.
And because that's what people are all upset. Now, I still don't understand this. You see on the paper today about the Coast Guard is going to cut money minimum. Wait a minute. They still get an increase of the money. And check them out. Look at the figures. Every agency got more money this year, will get more money this year than they did last year if they're talking about these terrible cuts they got to make. Now, that's just smoke and mirrors and trying to make it painful for people. If you're operating that inefficiently last year, shame on you.
And have you proposed the 10% idea?
I've talked about it. But I mean,
I'm just wondering how the likelihood of it going through.
I don't know. But it should. It's a simple way to do it. Because everybody's got skin in the game of it. Why would I be interested in government if I'm not paying the fact that I'm receiving from? I don't really care. As long as I keep getting what I want to. And then people vote for saying they're going to continue to give it to you. And your entrepreneurship, your ability to make a living is diminished because you're become dependent. And that's not good.
Okay. On something in your southeast region, I see there's been a revised version of the Sea Alaska Land Exchange Bill passed. And what sort of traction does it have this time around in this current?
Well, I passed it out of the House last time. This is a lot going to be dependent on those two senators, and if they pass something that is acceptable to Sea Alaska, I'll look at it very closely because that's their decision. I am right now sticking by my guns and my bill because I believe this is the fairest of all the bills. But they've been negotiating on the Senate side because that's where the bottleneck's been all the whole time.
And another state question, if I could, if you followed the oil tax debate in the state legislature.
I have no understanding of what they're talking about, I'll be honest here. And if anybody else says they do, they're pulling your leg. But having said that, I do know what is evident. We're losing flow in the pipeline. And it's dramatic. We are doing everything we can to keep what oil we have flowing, but remember it's the oil is cold now, so they have to heat it, mm-hmm. And they're going to come down. they're setting in a new system. At the above pump station one, where they collect the oil in a big tank, and they settle the water out. See, that the problem is the less oil you have, and it's colder anyway, there's still water in it. And that water in the coal causes a problem. So right now they're heating it so that they can ship it down, but that takes money and time. And so now what they're going to have to do is, and because the pipeline, which I never understood, the pipeline's relatively full, but it's slow. You know, that's what you base your volume on, is a speed per foot. When it was, we were pumping 2 million barrels, it was going quite rapidly. Now we're down to 600,000 barrels, so the pipeline's still like a long tube of toothpaste, but because it's going slower, that gives more time for the oil to cool more, and also gives more time for that water to become a real problem, because it can freeze and cause the sluggish just beyond that to a point where they can't, it won't move. So what they're going to try to do is put these huge tanks in, and they'll run the oil in, and then they'll let the water drop to the bottom. The oil will float to the top. It depends which one it is. And then they take the oil off, I mean the water off, and then they move the oil into the pipeline, and it still, they hope it won't have to be heated, because that's slow and expensive. That's what they're doing now. The only way you could avoid that is by adding more hot oil to the pool. And at one time, we had to cool oil down. It was up to 180 degrees when we first started pumping oil. So it made a lot of difference. So that's the challenge. If we don't get oil in that pipeline, I'm saying within the next 10 years, we're in deep ducky. And the frustrating thing to me, people say, well, this is a giveaway. Well, is it or isn't it? Because, you know, what is and what isn't? You know, I mean, if we don't get oil, if we don't give the incentive to drill, then we don't have anything. If we give an incentive to drill, does it cost us money? It does, but do we get a result from it? If we give money and we don't get a result from it, then it has been a bad deal. But right now, we're not doing anything. So I'm willing to have I'll back the government and say, okay, let's try this, let's see what happens. I don't understand it totally. I just know the flow of the line is very concerning to me, and I get briefings on that a lot. And I'm hoping they have some oil out of the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi and go in there. It won't be our oil, but we can charge for it and generate some revenues from that as transportation. I don't know.
Just briefly on that subject, there's moves now to bring some of the revenue from OCS to Alaska when oil starts to flow from there. Is there a likelihood that will actually get to the...
Well, I think that combination, at least from Murkowski and Mary Landro and the Gulf states have worked on this bill. And I think we'll be in. We were one time, you know, and I got over the years because we didn't do anything. It sunsetted on us, so I think there's a good chance that we'll be included in it. It'd sure be a lot better, though, if we were to get the oil off of ANWR and PET 4. I'm terribly irritated with Solars and the government by saying, oh, we opened up 80% of the PET 4 and it's a balanced approach. And see, no one ever went to the oil company and said, okay, what areas do you want? And let them have it and put the rest of it off limits. They arbitrarily, with no supposedly knowledge, but they know where the oil companies want to go, and they precluded that. So I actually used to have an old saying that there, just because the pool table is green, you don't hunt rabbits. You follow what I'm saying? That they open this is all open, 80% is open, but it's 80% where there's no oil. If that's the case, then I'll trade you the 80% for the 20% it wasn't open. Yeah. Oh, we can't do that. You know?
A slight change of subject. I went on your website this morning and saw you had introduced a measure to survey waterfront and shipping lines and an ocean study, and I was wondering if you could expand on that and what you hope that will accomplish and how it will benefit Alaska.
mainly is for the Arctic. One of my biggest concerns is that I do think with the, if you look at the capability of Russia, and even China is building icebreakers now, and for Finland's always had icebreakers. They're looking at it not just to break ice, they're looking at it commercially to break channels. And I believe we need to be involved 200 miles out, especially. We need to be involved in what channels are open. It's like a two-way highway, one going one way, the other. We can't have ships colliding with one another. And we should be studying the bottom of the oceans, making sure the topography down there, and the whole concept. Because I expect to see Russia and China primarily, because the markets, if they can go through that ice, which they can with those new ones, Russia's got 5 nuclear icebreakers now, and they're making all nuclear icebreakers, which is interesting, because they don't have to refuel them. So they can keep active all for long periods of time, and they will right behind them. It'll become these freighters that will be going into Europe, and vice versa. And that cuts off god awful amounts of time, and you don't have to go through the Panama Canal or anything else. So we ought to be involved. And it's one of my frustrating things with people. Oh, we can't drill up there. We don't need this up there. They're going to do it. And right now, if they go through our 200 mile limit, they could do it in a heartbeat. There's no way to stop them. We're not trying to stop them. We want to navigate them to make sure they go to the right place at the right time.
How much do you think Arctic development could help Alaska?
Well, it all depends. It's extremely helpful to any state lands that are landlocked. It's very helpful to any native lands that are available to the coastal waters. If you look at the geological structure of the globe, the majority of mineralization is above the Arctic circle, and the reason it's been locked up all this time, there's no way to get it out, and so that means Russia and Canada too, and Iceland and the rest of them. That's where the majority of deposits of mineralization occur, including fossil fuels, but it's always been relatively landlocked. And so now they'll have access to, and that means a great deal of benefit to any resource we want to develop above the Arctic Circle, which we do have land up there, especially the native groups.
I know there's been a local push to try and improve our potential support base for Arctic development, to have this be an area where
it's the shipyard
on the way up. Is that
the shipyard mainly? Because there is no any other maritime facilities in Alaska that can handle icebreakers. You can build an icebreaker over here, or repair, or launching sites. And this is why I'm so pleased with the dedication yesterday of the Assembly Hall, because that yard has a great potential for the city of Ketchikan and for the state of Alaska. But it's got, you know. And with the fishing fleet, like I said yesterday, with the ability to build ships, I believe when this ship comes out, the Prowler, the Arctic Prowler comes out, people that do have money, the Pitcairn Group, which is a very large group, you're going to see them repair and build here. And that's a plus for this area. Because other than the small marina and Seward, there's no ability to work on ships.
I bring
one, two.
Greetings from Tina Williams.
How is she, by the way?
She's doing very well.
Okay, good.
Her question would be, which was one you heard last night about the money flowing overseas to places like Egypt and in the current situation, and was wondering what your response is.
Well, and the thing, and I'm actually at a lack of answer for that. I don't see how the president can give Egypt $250 million without the okay of the Congress. He doesn't have the purse strings. If you follow what I'm saying, and there's a great deal of resentment of money that's going overseas to people that are not our friends. It's sort of like playing robbery, you know. Excuse me a moment. I'll call you back. So, you know, it's a good question. I hope more people ask that question. Because when I get back, I'm going to talk to the Ryan, and I'm going to say, where and how can he do that without the okay of the Congress? And I don't think we're going to give him the okay for that, especially when you get not having White House tours. And you think about that jackass when you think about it. He gets an airplane, $167,000 an hour to fly that Air Force One. And he cancels the White House tours? I mean, this guy is about as arrogant as... I've been under 8 presidents. He's probably the most arrogant of any of them I've ever met. He really believes he's king. That's very frustrating. And he wants to change this country into a monarchy. And it's just not because he's a Democrat. I've served under more Democrat presidents than I am. Well, I'm about equal. Let's see. I served with Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama. So I think it's about even. And he is the most arrogant of all the presidents I've served under. He's not incompetent, but he's arrogant. Jimmy Carter was totally incompetent. I always blame him. How he could criticize George W. Bush about foreign policy when the whole Middle East collapse was created by himself. You remember that?
Vaguely.
Well, that's when he said the people of Iran should be allowed to pick their own leaders, so we're not supporting the Shah anymore. And that's where you got Ayatollah. That's where you got the right-wing brotherhood. That's where you got the women stuck in the closet. And the whole bit. And it's all his fault. And he says he doesn't have a good foreign policy, talking about George W. Bush. But anyway.
Getting back to foreign aid, though, the Egypt question aside, are you in favor of cutting foreign aid in general that Congress has approved, or is that something you would look
at? No, specifically. Not in general, specifically. I would support Israel. I would support countries. I support Turkey, Greece, which they don't like. But I am not going to support Egypt nor Iran. We give the money to Iran. I sit here and beat our drums and say, okay, and it's just not the way to do it. And I think you're going to see a different foreign policy bill coming out as far as gives money. And the president has no right to say, I'm going to give you this kind of money. He has a right to say it, but he shouldn't have the money, let's put it that way.
And you talked a little bit about this last night as well, as far as your longevity in Congress.
Yes.
And I was just wondering if you see an end to things, or if you're just going to keep on going as long as you
want. I'm sort of like one of these meteors that fly through the sky. Until I totally dim out, I'm still going to fly.
I know you get that question a lot. So.
No, you know, I'm really. June 9th, I'm 40. This has been a good year. I passed my 40th year. I've exceeded any public servant in the state of Alaska. I've passed more legislation than any congressman in Congress, and I'm always proud of that. Nobody knows that. So I've had a good career. Do I want it to end? Not really. I'm having a good time. But I'm also realist to know that June 9th, I'll be 80 years old. And you never know. You know, a car can be running really good, but you get 150,000 miles on it, you're liable to blow a gasket. You know, and, so you never know. You know, just pray that you don't have a blowout in the tire when you're doing 90 miles an hour. It gets kind of hairy then. So, but I like what I do, and And I'll be replaced someday by, I say, God, or some of the public will get tired of me. Time goes by, and you know, I'm realist enough to know that. And I won't change my policy or my philosophy about where I think people should be. And I listen to them very carefully. And I disagree sometimes, and most of the time I'll agree if I think they're right. And I'd be surprised how many people think I'm right. And that's what makes me feel good about myself sometimes.
People generally know exactly where you stand.
Yes, sir. And even the members back there, that's my proudest moment. They know full good and well. You mess with Alaska, you better get ready to get your lunch bill. I'm going to kick out of you. And they're good that way. I mean, I'd say my biggest failure was the timber industry, because I had a whole regiment of George Millers and Jimmy Carters and everybody saying we can't afford to cut it. And then I think it's the greatest loss to the state of Alaska and to this nation as a whole, because it is a renewable resource. Not to have it properly managed is just criminal. You know. And it will come back. You won't see it, but it will come back. You can't leave that much fiber on the ground while some people are finally saying this is a bad idea. Okay.
I should ask any comment regarding the most recent House ethics.
You know, the only comment is nothing new. I'm a little frustrated, of course. You know, I'm working with the committee and have always worked with the committee. I've asked them, period, to tell me if I've done anything wrong. They've never responded. So we just go with it and see what happens. I'm in my own heart of hearts, though I'm personally legitimate in what I've done. The frustrating thing is they've gone back to 2001. There is such a thing as a statute of limitations, in the sense that there's different rules then. And I think they're trying to apply this year's rules to the 2001 rules. And it's all about flying. I used to fly with everybody. You know, I think of it, and by the way, personal friends is what I'm saying. And no, you can't do that. But we'll see. We'll see who's right and who's wrong. I know this, the money they spent trying to prove that I'd done something wrong between the Justice Department and the Ethics Committee could have taken and kept the White House tours open for 4 years.
Yeah.
That's right.
How much do the White House tours cost, anyway? Just out of curiosity.
$75,000 a week. And it never used to cost hardly anything, but now, holy boy, you got so much security to go through. I mean, it's just terrible. Kids. They go through this checkpoint, and they go through this checkpoint, and then their backpacks are checked here, and da-da-da-da-da. And it's not a good tour anymore. It's very, very shortened. But most people want to go say they've been to the White House. I've got a house in my right close to my community, my home, that is a total duplicate of the White House. It's smaller, but the same everything. But and hell, I'm going to go to that guy's door and say, you know, why don't you open your house for White House tours? He could make a lot of money, and he can hire one of the neighbors to play Obama, and they could actually meet Obama and Michelle. I mean, they make a bundle of money, you know.
And create a few jobs.
Oh, no, oh, so create a few jobs, and the kids wouldn't know any difference. But the guy that built it, he's a character, by the way, but the guy that built it did it right to the very end of... Wow. Of modeling the rooms inside, the Oval Office, the bedrooms, the whole thing is a miniature White House, but it's quite large. It's like 6 or 8, 10,000 square feet, but it's not as big as the White House. It looks exactly. You go up to it, take a picture of it. I used to do that, stand in front of the White House, you know, like I was been visiting the president. And by the way, if you can't have fun in this job, you should never be in it.
Yeah.
That's what people don't understand about me. And I don't think I've ever been unhappy. Now, I've been mad and angry, but even then I'm happy. And I think that's, people look at me sometimes, you got to be, you know what? And I say, no, I'm having a good time. All right, guys. You've had me long enough.